Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
And this week for the writers, another edition of The Lit Lunch. With 49 books to her name, Fiona McIntosh truly is a master Australian storyteller, crossing genres, historical settings, and far-flung locations. Her latest historical fiction novel, The Soldier's Daughter, is a testament to her enduring and versatile talent as an author. Ruby Nash has grown up in the shadows of her father's shattered dreams. It's been years since he walked away from the battlefields of France, a World War I hero, but his heart in tatters, only to see it broken all over again in the worst possible way. Sailing for Australia to Tasmania, the pair work to fulfill his dream of setting up a whiskey distillery. Ruby shows a rare talent for the fine art of distilling and plans to follow in his footsteps. But as Second World War rages on, Charlie feels the pull once more to play his heart and is lured back into action. It comes as no surprise to Ruby when Charlie's footsteps lead him back to Champagne, where open arms, future hopes, and past ghosts lie waiting. Charlie must prove his bravery in the ultimate act of sacrifice. But it is Ruby, the soldier's daughter, who will fight to claim his lasting legacy. Here's Fiona McIntosh.
I have to tell you that I do not plan my stories. I have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. I've got no actual storyline set out. I've just got my main character. I usually have two. And I know the motif for the story. So with the Champagne War, I knew it was going to be all about champagne, but I didn't know what was going to happen. But you were all very cranky with where I left Charlie. And I said, Charlie made his own decisions in that book. You know, where he ended up is where, you know, he decided to go. But that wasn't good enough for the readership. I kept thinking, if I go quiet, they'll leave me alone. But you didn't. For 6 years, you've been hammering away at me saying, what about Charlie? Anyway, here I stand with that sequel written for you. And I think some people have already read it, which is terrifying because that's 3 years worth of research just down the drain in a night because you read it so fast. Somebody did say to me, I read it in a night and I just wanted to black out because, you know, that's a lot of work. So I went to Penguin, my publisher, and said, I'm thinking of doing a book about whiskey. And they were very excited about that. They said, yes, I think my publisher loves whiskey. Probably does a bit of that at home. So she said, Fiona, I would love... And she said it from the ground. Fiona, I would love it if you'd write me a whiskey book. No, I'm being mean. She's not like that at all. But she does love whiskey. And she said, please write a whiskey book and we will publish it for you. So then dawned on me, oh, this might be a lovely channel to bring Charlie back interview and please the audience that have been asking for him all this time. So I thought, yes, it can work because Charlie's a chemist from the Champagne War. He's coming back from the trenches. He's left behind somebody very special in France and he's got to get on with his own life now. And I thought, okay, he's going to become a whiskey distiller and blender. And that made a lot of sense to me. So the first thing I had to do once I decided to do this was to work out where, you know, place. Where are we going to set this? And I decided to set it, obviously, in Scotland. And then I thought the whiskey industry in Australia has come of age. We are now on the global map for whiskey. And I thought I'd quite like to bring the story out into Australia. So that's all I had going in. Charlie, whiskey, Scotland, Tasmania. And that was my story. And I said to my publisher, okay, well, if the Champagne War was all set in war, then I'm going to set this in peacetime. It's just going to happen in peacetime. Famous last words. So why I'm saying that is 60,000 words into writing this book, and that's halfway, you know, 60,000 words is halfway. I began to get the sort of, you know, when something's going wrong, you feel that first chill through your body before you actually accept that something's gone wrong. You get that nasty creeping feeling up your spine. Well, I realized I'd got my timeline spectacularly wrong in the story. And Violet, Charlie's daughter, who had become very important in the story suddenly, I didn't know she was going to, she kept pushing into every scene. And I've learned over all these books I've written, if somebody arrives into the pages, let them stay, let them play for a while, because you can always write them out again. But she was determined to be in this story front and center. So it was becoming a story about Violet, Charlie's daughter. Anyway, I'm merrily writing away, and I got this feeling, and I thought, just a minute, got out my calculator and did my calculations and realized that Violet was far too young in the story to be doing all the things that I thought she would be able to do, grown-up things that she should have been able to do that she suddenly couldn't do based on the timeline I was in. So I was now facing, do I throw away 60,000 words, which to a writer is, you know, you might as well, you want to just climb in a hole, or do I accept that I am going to have to take this story into the Second World War, which I was trying to avoid. And I decided I did not want to throw away 60,000 words of hard toil. So I let that door slam on me. And suddenly I had to go forwards. And as that door slammed, as is usual in life, another one opened. And it was like a choir of heavenly angels singing to me. Imagine it, you know, that beautiful sound, beautiful light coming through and saying to me, that's okay. If you're going into war, you can take Charlie back to France. And it was this wonderful full circle idea. My gosh, I hadn't even let that thought even come into my mind. And not only can Charlie, look, I'm getting goosebumps. Not only can I let Charlie go back to France, but who's in France waiting for Charlie? Who is it? Say it, Sophie. Yes, well done, everyone here. Full marks. Sophie is waiting in Epernay. They're both married. They're both 20 years older. And I became so excited. Now, this is being recorded, so I hope they can edit this out. But I got very excited at the thought. It made my nipple stand on end. Edit that out. That I wanted this whole meeting of Charlie and Sophie not expecting to meet. They are not expecting to see each other. And I thought, this could be the best scene in the book, you know? And I want it to be full of suspense, and I want it to be full of drama, and I want it to be full of tension, that Sophie's not expecting it, Charlie's not expecting it. The Germans are occupying Epernay, so you can begin to gather what's going on here. So I am now not going to tell you anything more about the Soldiers' War, because, yes, you have to go to the Dimmock's counter and buy it. Yes, you do. I don't want to spoil the story. It really is a powerful scene that was very exciting to write, very satisfying to write, that these two are going to finally meet again. But I'll leave it at that. I will say, if you are buying The Soldier's Daughter, please buy a box of tissues with it. Yes, it's your fault. You wanted it. You've got it. You know, it's going to break your heart at some point, and but you can have a little tot of whiskey next to you and just have that. So let's talk about the research of making this book come to light. I started in Tasmania. Bill Lark, some of you might have heard of him. He's the godfather of whiskey in this country. Now, he started making whiskey legally, and I must qualify that because it was all illegal before then. 1991 was his first legal bottle of whiskey. Up until then, who knows what he was doing. But He had a license to make whiskey in Tasmania from 1991. But I wanted my characters, I wanted Charlie and Violet to be making whiskey in the 1930s. So I've taken a liberty, but I'm allowed because I'm a fiction writer. So I can do whatever I like, so long as it feels real to you, and it will. They were making legal whiskey in the 1930s in this story. So I thought, let's read up a little bit about Bill Lark. And I realised he had a daughter called Christy. And I thought, that's rather nice because Charlie's got Violet and Bill's got Christy. I'll try and meet Christy. So I got in touch with her and she said, yeah, come on down to Richmond in Tasmania. Let me teach you everything I can about making whiskey. And boy, did she put me through my paces. You know, I now believe that if Dimmock set up a little still here, I could make us some moonshine that we could all quite happily knock back in the next. She really made sure that I understood the science of making whiskey. And what I didn't realise is that it starts out, it could go one way and become beer because it's barley, or it could go the other way and become this high-end spirit. So that was lovely to learn that. I didn't know that. But the reason Tasmania works is because it replicates Scotland so well. That cool climate, the pure water. The barley grows really well in Tasmania, and that's why they were able to build that industry. And down the road is a brewery that can give you, Cascade is just down the road, can give them the malted barley they need to make the whiskey. So that's why that industry grew up so fast and so well there. Anyway, so having put me through my paces and feeling confident, Christy, feeling confident that I could now go and make whiskey, distill it if I needed to, she said, come on, come to the barrel room with me. Come and meet the whiskey that I make. And we walked into the... It's a shed. I was expecting, an underground cave, a bit like the Champagne or like a lovely wine cellar or something. Nothing doing. It's just a shed. But inside that shed, there are windows and the sun is just allowed to come in softly from the right angle at the right time of day. And there are dust motes dancing in the air. And the barrels are quite small. Whiskey barrels are small. They're usually sherry casks. So that's what they love. A good old Pedro Jimenez that has been made in that cask will then be used for whiskey, and it will draw down all those flavours, those syrupy sweet flavours into the whiskey, give it its colour, give it its lovely sweetness. So port, sherry, any fortified will work. So there are these small barrels sort of sitting in a cradle being rocked, you know, and they're all asleep because they're sleeping for years and years, 25 years. They're just sitting there and being rocked. The birds are singing lullabies outside. And I thought, gosh, I love this heavenly space. It feels like a chapel, like you would come in here to commune with, whatever. You could commune with your own self, even. It's just such a love. And I thought, I'm going to write an important scene in here because it's so beautiful. Anyway, Christy said to me, right, she knocked the bung off a barrel and said, time for you to taste some whiskey. Now, what I hadn't admitted, and I think they should edit this out as well because I don't want her to hear it, is that I am a teetotaler and I do not drink alcohol at all. Not because I'm puritanical. I just don't like it, you know? Give me a good old Coke Zero anytime, you know? So I was, if the champagne war was hard enough, which it was, I was knocking back flutes of champagne on your behalf in Epinay. The lengths I'll go to for this group, I'm telling you. So I thought, right, well, I'm at that very pointy end now. And she said, she got down this tool from the wall, and it's called a spirit thief. And it's a long tool, and you dip it into the barrel and put your thumb over the top, and it sucked up some of the spirit inside. And then you hold it over a little glass, and you take your thumb off, and out comes the spirit, you see. And she told me, we call that a spirit thief. And I thought, oh, gosh, I'd like to call the book The Spirit Thief. That's so romantic. Anyway, she said, right, go on, Fiona. And I thought, I've got to do it. I've got to knock this back. She's staring at me. So the vapors alone... You know, I was feeling like I had vertigo just smelling the vapors. So as I do this and knock the whole toddy back into my mouth, Christy says, Of course, that's 63% proof. And I've now got a mouthful of 63% proof alcohol. And she said, it's illegal at that level. We've got to get it down to 43%. And I thought, just swallow. And I swallowed. And the burn. It was incredible. And I swear, if Christy had lit a match, we'd have all gone up. Me and the babies, we'd have just blown up. You know, there was so much vapor around. And, oh, gosh, it burned. But it was wonderful. And she said, have a look inside. I was trying to look inside this barrel. And I noticed that a lot of the whiskey wasn't there. The liquid had gone. It wasn't me, I promise. And I said, how does that work? That was that full? She said, oh, yes, it's full to begin with. And I said, that's an odd business model that you're going to lose so much of your liquid. And she said, oh, no, Fiona, we call that the angel share. So... and they do. Or she said, all around the world, wherever whiskey is being made, 30% we give to the angels. And I thought, oh, I want to call my book The Angel Share, because that's so lovely, so romantic. Anyway, she said, you are now ready to go to Scotland. And I thought, yep, okay, off we go. And she said, but I want you to go and stay in a place called Cardew House. There's a guy there called Colin, and he's married to Sarah, and they will, he is a total connoisseur of whiskey, and he will teach you lots and lots and introduce you to all the right people that you need to know. So we duly booked, we just booked like ordinary guests and paid up whatever we had to do, but she'd obviously told Colin, you know, look after these two because Fiona's going to need some help. So now we're flying into an Aberdeen winter. The two of us, me and my husband, who you've heard about many times. So we're flying into this Aberdeen winter, and I thought Ian was a bit jumpy on the flight. I thought, what's going on here? Why is he's got ants in his pants about something. You know, what's going on? And then I thought, oh, no, I hope he doesn't think we're on a promise, because I'm working, Ian, I'm working. No, 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 we're not going to do all that you've got in mind in your family seat of the McIntosh clan. No. I mean, he might have had visions of kilts and also bagpipes, all sorts of, edit that out maybe. So anyway, we finally arrived where our car, he's hired the car, you see, and he's hired the car for me to drive him around, right? So he's not driving, I'm driving. And we get there and I look at it and I said to him, what is in your mind? What is in your head? And he said, well, I just thought I'd treat us. There is this low-slung sports car waiting for us. I just wanted a Toyota Yaris. That's all I wanted, a little bubble car that we could drive. He's got this low-slung beast waiting for us. And he said, oh, I just thought we'd have some fun. And... gosh, so he said, anyway, let's get in. So we get, you know what it's like being this age to get in down that low. It's like you got to rock yourself down to get that low. Hope your thighs hold up and your knees don't pop and your spine doesn't go and all that. So we both finally get in with that sound, oof, that our age make. So we're finally in there and we've got the key and I cannot find the hole to put the key in. There's nowhere. And we looked and we looked and we looked and there was nowhere to put this key. Now, I had a good idea of where I'd like to put that key. There was one place that it deserved to go. But he said, let's get our phones out, get our torches. So how quickly can you find your torch? It took us ages to find our torch, right? Two silly old boomers in a sports car in the middle of an Aberdeen winter trying to find your torch. So we finally find the torch and we're all over the dashboard, nowhere to put the key except in Ian if I was going to. And I said, there must be a button. So we start looking for a button, and then we can't find the button. So I said, okay, I'm ringing the boys. I'm ringing Australia. So I'm just dialing out, you know, 0116, whatever it is. And Ian said, stop. And I stopped. I thought he'd found the button, but he said, don't ring them. We will never live it down. And he said, they will have carers waiting for us at the airport. And I said, no, you're right. We shouldn't. They get enough mileage out of us already. So definitely not. So I said, right, I'm going to go and get the woman. So it took me another 10 minutes to get back out, to get over there, find someone. They were locking up. I said, no, you have to come and help us start this car. And she must have thought, and I'm letting you go away with all of that, and you can't even start it. Anyway, she leaned in and pressed a button right in front of me, and the car came on, the lights came on, the radio came on, the windscreen wipers came on. And she said, all right. It was so sarcastic, you know. And I let it go because I thought, I just need us to get on the road. And the thing is, we never did learn how to turn off the windscreen wipers. So for the whole journey, we had that. I mean, for the whole 4 days, we were like this. And we never learned how to turn off the radio. So we were shouting at each other over the... I hated that car so much. Off we went into the dead of night, into Aberdeen. And I tried following her. I was like Mr. Magoo. I tried following a lorry for a while. And I thought, every time he bends, I'm going to bend this car and just follow his headlights. But then even he peeled off and we were in the Highlands, you know. It was so frightening. Anyway, finally got to Cardew House. And Colin came rushing out and said, God, I thought we'd expect you hours ago, you know, so we were really late. He said, go to bed. I'll see you in the morning. Just go and have a good night's sleep. So we couldn't even see the house at this stage. We just ran up and got into bed. And the next morning woke up early and threw back the curtains. And it was just the most glorious sight. It was like an old rectory that we were in. It was a most beautiful little manor house. It had a walled garden. There were beautiful little bulbs or snowdrops or something like that that were out looking so pretty. And then there was a forest to one side and then rolling hills like a patchwork quilt. It was beyond beautiful. And I said to Ian, I think Violet is going to live here. Already, I know that she has to be in this house. So that felt good. So I could already tick a box that I've barely been here hours, but I know the location where a lot of this story will take place. And then we went downstairs and Ian learned the great joy of whiskey-laden porridge. So, she was throwing it in. And now every morning, I make him whiskey porridge and he staggers off with his wheelbarrow on his merry way up. Because I always put more than I should. The porridge goes sort of brown, you know, it doesn't stay lovely white, it goes brown because I put in Chivas or whatever I can find. And off he goes, happy as Larry, weaving a merry path. So I left him behind in the house to enjoy the surrounds, and Colin and I went off on this magical mystery tour, calling into all the distilleries, and it was magic. It really was magical. I was meeting all these archivists and curators and whiskey people who were so knowledgeable, but they were very excited that I could remember whiskey labels from the 60s, because anyone who grows up in England, their father would have almost certainly drunk scotch. And so my dad was a scotch drinker, and I knew every label from those years. You know, I remember him drinking it. And they were so impressed that I knew VAT 69 and, you know, Teachers and all these labels that have now gone. They've been swallowed up and taken over by the bigger corporations. You know, big drinks companies own lots of labels. So it's a bit sad. They're called ghost distilleries now. But the one that was the most exciting is when he took me up to Cardew Distillery behind the house. And there I learned, to my astonishment, that three women were responsible for the whiskey industry becoming very commercial in Scotland and the world. Now, you would have thought, as I did, that whiskey was very much a man's domain in those times. So I'm going back 100 years. It was a male-dominated industry. Women were nowhere to be seen. And my character, I'm pushing her. I want her to be this fabulous whiskey blender, you know. So I'm pushing back against the norms of society with this story. But there were these three true life women who'd done it. And it was marvelous because in those times, every household was making moonshine. every household. And she lived at the top of a hill, and she told the excise and tax man, come to me first. I'll always have the kettle on for you, and I'll always have some lovely baps in the oven for you. And this was a very cunning move, because he would come to her first. And what she'd do, if she saw him coming along, she was on the hill, she would run out to the back porch and dig this red flag into the ground, and the whole village would see the red flag, and they would pick up their stills and run into caves and hide them. So the taxman never found illegal stills in Speyside because of her. True story. Absolutely magnificent. And then what she'd do was throw flour all over herself. And as the door opened, she'd say, oh, I've got a lovely, you know, she'd be pulling out warm baps from the oven. She'd bake them every morning in case he came. And she'd pour him a pot of tea and buy the village time to go and get rid of everything that's illegal. And he never caught her. He never caught her. She was making more than anyone else. And so she was the first person to get a legal license. She decided to pay taxes and start legalizing Great Scotch. And her daughter continued in a great vein, in the same vein, and then the daughter's daughter. And that daughter's daughter ended up marrying into a very wealthy grocery family. So suddenly there was big money coming together, and they made the Cardew Distillery become the Johnny Walker label that we know today. So that's how Johnny Walker came into being, because of three women. And what was, you know, sort of nipple blazing for about that, we might need to edit that, is that there were three women in the champagne story that gave us champagne. You know, those three women, people like Veuve Clicquot, they took over their husbands' empires and, you know, they commercialized champagne so that it was no longer a drink for royalty and aristocrats. It became the party drink, the drink you paid for quite expensively, but to celebrate, because you had something special to celebrate, an engagement or a wedding or a birth. You wanted the very best. And they commercialized champagne. And here it was happening in my whiskey story, three women. Plus I had Violet and Charlie, and I had Christy, and I had Bill Lark. And I thought, the readership was right. They bullied me into writing this story, but I was always meant to write this story. So it felt really good by the time I came back from Scotland that I had so much information about whiskey, and I'd drunk a lot of it as well. And it is very much an acquired taste. You have to learn how to drink whiskey. And the other thing I took away from it and that I lean into in the story, I think is important, is that whiskey... If champagne is the party starter, whiskey's the opposite. Who drinks whiskey here? Anyone? Plenty of you. So whiskey, hopefully you'll agree, is a drink that unlocks memory. It's a drink that you sit quietly and sip. It's not something you need necessarily to share with somebody. You can just quietly sip your scotch or your whiskey, wherever it's from, and it unlocks your thoughts. It allows you to think back over whether it's your day or your week or your life. So many people said to me, whiskey is memory. It unlocks it. So I love that. And so I'm leaning into that in the story as well. So I don't want to say too much more about that story. I just, you know, I really hope you all enjoy it. So far, so good. Everyone who's read it has loved it. But I thought I might take you back to the champagne story that gave us this book and tell you about how I met Sophie. Do you all know how I met? Have I said this to you before? Well, it's a nice story, so I might share it. So Ian and I, once again, we were on our way on your behalf into Epinay to get this champagne story. And the way I work, I've told you I don't plan anything. I have to put myself down on the ground in the place where I think this story should take place and wait for the story to find me. Wait for my characters to, I know this sounds woo-woo, but just tiptoe up, tap me on the shoulder and say, this is us, we are your story. And so this always terrifies Ian, that this is how I work, because all of you would know that travel is very expensive and to be on the ground just waiting for a story to find you is, you know, lots of plane fares and accommodation and food and transfers and taxis and what have you. It's expensive to be on the ground in Europe. So we get off and he's like, right, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's find this story. And we're walking down the Avenue de Champagne, which is the major road in Epinay, where all the grand houses are saying, look at us, we're Moët. You know, we're the best champagne in the world. Or there's Bollinger saying, no, no, look at us. Or Laurent Perrier or someone like, you know, all these big champagne houses screaming at you. And they're very ostentatious buildings. So we're walking and Ian leaned in and he said, is it happening yet? It's so annoying. And I said, no, it's not happening. Leave me alone. And then we'd walk a little bit further and he'd say, should we go and get a drink? And I, no, just, you've got to let the story come to me, Ian. And he kept saying, come on. I could hear him saying it. Come on, come on. Something needs to happen. And you could see him thinking the dollars are just flicking away from me. Anyway, we came to the end of the street. And he was like, oh, no, it's all over. You know, it's a waste of time. But there was this fairy tale chateau, just tiny little quiet thing at the end of the street. And if you look at the champagne wall, the inside cover, that is the house that I saw. And I said, I stopped and he said, it's happening, isn't it? And I said, yeah, I think if I want the story to be set here. Here's my champagne house. And he was like, oh, he nearly fainted with joy that we'd finally got this. So it was very, very pleasing. So I put my phone around the gates. They were wrought iron. And I was trying to take a photograph of this house because I thought, yeah, I'll set it there. And there were some tradies working and one of them peeled away and came. And it was a woman and she was dressed in like dirty dungarees with paint all over it. And she said, can I help you? And we said, oh, sorry, do you mind if we take a photo? And she said, why are you taking a photo? And at this moment, I don't know why, but we both answered exactly the same way in exactly the same split second. And it was like we were giving her the answer to the universe. Like, this is it. We're going to now tell you all the answers you've ever needed to know. And we both said, oh, we're Australian. That was our answer. We thought that was enough, you know. And she said, we love Australians, well done, sort of thing. And she said, but why are you here? So I don't sort of go around saying, oh, I'm a writer, but I thought, well, she's pressing, she needs to know. So I told her what I was doing. And she said, would you like to see inside the house? And look, before she'd finished her sentence, I had picked up my skirt and run. I was trying to break into that house before she could change her mind. But I sort of skidded like Roadrunner and thought, stop, stop. You know, this is not fair. There's a family that lives here and it's not right to just barge in. And she was coming up quietly with Ian and she said, what's wrong? And I said, oh, I don't think we should just go inside like this. The family might not like it. And she said, no, I am the family. I own this. So she said, come on in. She brought us in. She sat Ian down with a magnum of champagne. He couldn't have been happier. And she said, come on, Fiona, let's go. And she took me through every single inch of that house. It was magnificent. It was just the most beautiful place. And we went up, there's about four stories, and we finally went into the fifth story, which was the attic. And we climbed up a ladder, and it was all messy, but it was brilliant. And she said, I'm going to turn this into my personal suite. I'm going to live up here because I've dreamed of this since I was a little girl. So it's her family home. And she said, we walked over to the window and all I could see was lovely vineyards stretching out. And I thought, oh gosh. And I realized over the course of that time I'd been with her that I was falling in love with Sophie and that I said, Sophie, you are my character. You are the champagne maker in my story. She's a sixth generation champenoise who had learned at her father's knee, and she's the only one left. So she carried the whole full weight of that family, six generations on her shoulders. And I said, can I use you in my story? And she said, okay, I'll make a deal with you. She said, you can have me, you can have my name, you can have my wisdom. I will teach you everything you need to know about champagne. I will give it all to you on one condition. And I said, sure. There was nothing she could say that could frighten me. I didn't think. And she said, I want to have a torrid affair. please let me have this torrid romance. And I said, oh, I can do that for you. I can give you lots of fun in that regard. She said, but there's a caveat. She said, I want this torrid romance, but I don't want to be unfaithful to my husband. And I thought, oh, gosh, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. But I said, right, yes, of course, thinking, how am I going to do that? But the fact is, that's why Charlie, at the end of the Champagne War, doesn't get to consummate that gorgeous, gorgeous love affair that's going on between him and Sophie. He can't, because I'd made a promise to the real Sophie that she wouldn't be unfaithful to her husband. So that's why that happened. And I'm glad I could share that with you, because a lot of people are like, you were so unfair to her and to him. But it's nice to share that. And just finishing off there, we went back on your behalf all up four times to Epinay. To get that story. And that's why it's a great story, actually, because I've been there so many times for you. And on the last time we went, she said, I don't want you staying in a hotel. I want you staying with us. So, because we'd become such good friends. And I said, okay, thank you. That's lovely. But the day we arrived, her father had passed away. Very sad. And so the whole family had gone. They'd had to go wherever they were going, into rural France, where her father was living, had been living. And but she'd left keys, she'd left notes, she'd left a full fridge. She said, let Ian just drink his way through the cellar. He can have what, take down anything he likes and just drink it. And she said, and you have a wonderful time. And we had this chateau to ourselves for a whole week. And I used to stand at the window in the kitchen that overlooked the main street, remembering that I walked down that street once as a stranger. And there were all these tourists, because they come in by the busload. You know, they drop them by the busload in Epinay. And a busload of people got off and were standing there and going, oh, look, this is lovely. And then they saw me. I made sure they did. I was sort of like, you know. They saw me. And then so I wish I smoked, because I would have done... I would have looked fabulous in that window, but instead I just had my coffee and I thought, I'll turn onto my best side. And it was like the paparazzi. It was marvellous. They all thought I was the champagne owner, you know, and I thought I better not go outside because they might say something and then I'd have to weave a merry tale. But that was really fun, and I did crawl over that house, every inch of it. I knew it so well. I knew every creak on every step of that house. And so when you can do that as a writer, when you can really walk in the footsteps of your characters, you can really then topple your reader who then opens that book. You want them to feel cocooned by this atmosphere that you drop them into. So they really believe, I want you to really believe you're in 1930s Richmond or 1920s Scotland, and certainly in Epinay during the 1940s, during the Nazi occupation.
And that is Fiona McIntosh there for your Lit Lunch series here on ABC Radio.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.